This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to Navarra Live. I'm Michael Walker. It's been a big weekend in global politics. To talk about it, I'm joined by Ash Sarkar on tonight's show. Ash, how are you doing?
Are you just talking about Doja Cats at Coachella, or is it the whole Iran sending hundreds of drones to Israel thing? Because I was here to talk about Coachella.
Mainly the latter. I don't know if anyone else had the sort of, you know, somewhat bizarre experience on Saturday night. You know, I was at a meal at a friend's house or whatever. And then you get that update, which is that Iran have launched all these drones to go to Israel. And then they say, but it's going to take 5 hours to get there. And so there's just this huge wait. It's sort of like, well, this is kind of strange. You know, so it's normally be a very dramatic news story, but then there's this strange sort of liminal period of 5 or so hours while you're waiting for them to get closer to their targets. Coming up later on tonight's show, we'll look at David Cameron, who is caught out, I think, in a Sky News interview. It exposes the UK's hypocrisy on Iran's retaliatory attack. Rachel Riley has been forced to apologise for a tweet that has been branded as racist, and fired Israeli spokesperson Alon Levy has decided to carry on pretending he is an Israeli spokesperson. Stay tuned for all of that. Give us a follow and rating on Spotify. It really helps us out with the algorithm. On Saturday, and for the first time ever, Iran launched a direct attack on Israel from within its own territory. The assault was in retaliation for Israel's bombing of the Iranian consulate in Damascus earlier this month. That Israeli attack killed 13 people, including 7 Iranian Revolutionary Guards, one of them a senior general. Iran's attack this weekend involved 170 armed drones and around 30 cruise missiles launched in several waves over 5 hours. The weapons launched from within Iran's territory traveled around 1,100 miles to reach Israel. That meant that the drones took several hours to cover the distance, while the cruise missiles took around an hour. Air raid sirens sounded at over 720 locations across Israel in the hours before the attack. But according to Israel's military, most of Iran's munitions were intercepted before they were able to do any damage. That was due to a combination of Israel's Iron Dome defense system, as well as the aid of regional and Western allies. These included the US, UK, France, and neighboring Jordan. But Iran also launched around 120 ballistic missiles, seen here flying over Iraqi territory. Traveling outside of the Earth's atmosphere, they took only around 12 minutes to cover the 1,100 miles to Israel. Some of those were shot down outside of the atmosphere, reportedly by Israel's long-range Arrow air defense system. But others appear to have struck Israeli targets, with an American source telling ABC News that 5 struck Israel's Nevatim air base in southern Israel's Negev desert. Israel's described the damage to the base as minor, a claim that Iran disputes. Iran also claims to have struck a second airbase in Israel. Israeli civilians suffered very little harm in the attack, with 1 7-year-old girl severely injured by shrapnel and several others treated for minor injuries. As the barrage came to an end, Iran's mission to the United Nations released this statement. Conducted on the strength of Article 51 of the UN Charter pertaining to legitimate defense, Iran's military action was in response to the Zionist regime's aggression against our diplomatic premises in Damascus. The matter can be deemed concluded. However, should the Israeli regime make another mistake, Iran's response will be considerably more severe. It is a conflict between Iran and the rogue Israeli regime from which the US must stay away. For Israel, IDF spokesperson Daniel Hagari gave this statement.
The threat from Iran was met with the aerial, operational, technological, and intelligence superiority of a united defensive coalition of international allies led by the United States, together with Great Britain, France, and other partners in the region. Together, we intercepted 99% of the threat towards Israel. Together, we thwarted Iran's attack.
So on the face of it, Iran's attack doesn't appear to have been very successful. As Hagari said there, the IDF claims that 99% of Iran's missiles were shot down. But Iran's foreign minister has claimed that the country's military aims were fairly discreet, saying this: The Iranian military operation against Israel was limited and aimed at squadrons of F-35 aircraft. The Israeli attack on our consulate violates international laws and treaties, and we will not hesitate to defend our interests in the face of any attack. According to some, Iran achieved its objectives. This was Professor Syed Mohammad Mirandi of Tehran University on Sky News.
It's obvious that it was a major humiliation for the Israeli regime. They crossed a red line and they got punished for it. Of course, the Israelis can say 110% of the drones and missiles were downed. That's fine, but they can also take journalists to see the bases that the Iranians have said were severely damaged. They can easily do that today or tomorrow.
Are you sure it's major? Because I saw on Twitter you said it was just a small slap in the face.
Oh, it was a small slap in the face for Iran. The two bases were severely damaged. But Iran has a huge stockpile of drones and missiles. And Iran hasn't used its most advanced weapons. So if there's...
What would they be, Professor? Nuclear weapons?
No, they're more advanced drones and missiles. Iran is not like the United States, which has and uses and has already used nuclear weapons. Iran's peaceful program, as we've seen over the years, has been peaceful, and there's never been any evidence to show otherwise. But Iran has more advanced drones and missiles. And the very fact that the Americans don't want to be a part of any Israeli counter-response shows that the Americans know where the power lies. So the smart thing for the Israeli regime to do would be to refrain from responding. They got their punishment and they should live with it. They can say that 200% of the drones were downed and 300% of the missiles were down. But as long as they keep quiet, they'll be safe. But if they strike Iran again, it's going to get much worse.
So the professor there wanted to highlight Iran's strength. He's saying if Israel do a counterattack, we've got enough weapons to come back, or Iran has enough weapons to come back much stronger. However, most analysts believe Iran calibrated their attack precisely to avoid further escalation. They aren't that confident that if this sort of turned into a wider regional conflagration, they'd necessarily come out on top. Iran's foreign minister has said the country gave neighboring countries as well as the US 72 hours notice of its attack, a claim the US denies. Turkey, Iraq and Jordan, though, have all confirmed they were given advance notice, with Turkey's foreign ministry claiming it conveyed that information to Washington. That led General Joseph L. Votel, a former leader of the US military's Central Command, to tell the New York Times this about what Iran's attack shows. They can launch missiles that can reach Israel, even though they were shot down outside Israeli airspace. It's concerning, particularly for a country that is pursuing nuclear weapons capability. I think Iran is very concerned about what comes next if they were too effective. The early notification of what they were doing seems a little interesting to me. It is that telegraph nature of Iran's attack that meant it was easier for Israel and its allies to defend itself, or to defend Israel. And other analysts have focused on the significance of Israel's reliance on its allies. The Sunday Times diplomatic editor Roger Boys has written this. The fight back on Saturday night showed that Israel has only a limited self-sufficiency in security matters. It was dependent on US intelligence for the timing of the assault, for the location of many of the firing positions, and on the US, British, and French assistance to help shoot down the incoming munitions. The bill for the Iranian hardware was probably in the low millions of dollars. For the defense of Israel, more than $1 billion. Tehran had the capacity to send in more than the wave that was unleashed, but has so far chosen not to. Israel's reliance on its allies will impact its assessment of how best to respond to those attacks on the weekend. And in public, at least, those allies don't seem too keen for this to escalate further. Joe Biden is reported to have told Netanyahu to take the win, a reference to the fact that 99% of Iranian missiles were, we are told, shot down. And in an interview on NBC, National Security spokesperson John Kirby said this about the American position.
NBC News is reporting that President Biden, talking about the diplomatic outreach, told Prime Minister Netanyahu that the United States will not participate in offensive operations against Iran. Can you confirm that?
I won't go into the greater detail of the conversation with the Prime Minister. They did have a good chat last night.
What was the message? What was the broad message?
It was very clearly, we stand with you in your self-defense. That was the main message that the president delivered to the prime minister. He congratulated the prime minister and the IDF for the extraordinary job they did knocking things out of the sky. But I won't go into more detail. Again, I just go back to what the president has said time and time again. We don't seek an escalation. We don't seek a wider war in the region.
So did he warn Israel not to respond? Did he say take the win, as has been reported?
I think the president was, again, very clear with Prime Minister Netanyahu about the success that they enjoyed last night and the impact that that success ought to have.
Sources from inside the White House have been a little bit more explicit than Kirby. The BBC is reporting that the Americans have told Israel it won't join any retaliatory strikes on Iran. But the relevant issue here isn't so much whether the West will participate in any attack on Iran, but rather whether it will defend Israel if its own actions provoke another Iranian retaliation. So Israel doesn't really need the West to sort of join in an attack on Iran. What they need is for the West to say, well, if you're going to attack Iran and Iran responds, we'll defend you again, like this time. Israeli politicians, for their part, don't sound committed to avoiding escalation. A source from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office told NBC this: Israel is going to consult with all its partners, but ultimately it's Israel's decision as to what the response will be. Israel can't allow such a large attack over Israel without some kind of response, be it small or large. It's up to the war cabinet to decide now. So they're saying it's up to us and there shall be a response. Meanwhile, this was Israeli opposition leader Benny Gantz, who is also a member of Netanyahu's war cabinet.
Faced with the threat of Iran, we will build a regional coalition and exact a price from Iran in a way and at a time that suits us. And most importantly, in the face of the desire of our enemies to harm us, we will unite and become stronger.
Earlier today, I spoke to Seamus Malakafzali, a Beirut-based journalist focused on the politics of the Middle East. I began by asking him what he thinks Iran was hoping to achieve with the attack.
I think it was trying to restore, in the Western style of talking, it was trying to restore deterrence. I mean, for the past few years, Israel had been engaged in this campaign of striking at not only Hezbollah targets inside of Syria, but also striking at the IRGC directly, a state military arm of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And throughout this entire process, Iran had always threatened retaliation, commonly talking about, at the time and place of their choosing, and it had never really materialized. And because Israel saw this on-ramp that they could go to, where they could bomb an embassy belonging to Iran and not think that anything would come of it, Iran had to act finally. And doing the thing that it did in sending hundreds of drones, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles into Israeli territory, that sends a pretty overwhelming message, I think, that if Israel chooses to escalate further in the way that it has, that the next strike might be of some greater severity.
I mean, there are a couple of messages, though, aren't there? Because you could see it as, the message Iran is willing to attack Israel from its own territory, which is new. That is somewhat bold. But then also there's a message that Israel is perfectly capable with its allies of shooting down all of those missiles or drones. So, is there a case that this backfires and shows Israeli strength as opposed to Iranian strength?
I think that was the original script that Israel wanted. That is what Israel wanted out of this provocation that Iran, I think, I would say if I had to speculate, they wanted something that would have shown devastation of some kind, Israeli casualties of some kind, and it can use that as evidence that not only is the IDF strong in defending against Iran, but also it has justification to further brew conflict with Iran on a much stronger scale on Israel's terms specifically. But the bind that Israel is now in regards to Iran, I think is much stronger and much more difficult to break than Iran has, than Iran had before this. It has to balance this narrative in which Israel both shot down 99% of all projectiles that Iran fired, which I'm very skeptical of, considering the videos that have emerged from the night of the attacks, but also that Iran literally threatens the entire free world. This was a video that was published by the IDF shortly after the attack. The confusion over what angle to take is really palpable through the Israeli media machine at the moment, from the Israeli foreign ministry, from the IDF, from spokespeople on British outlets like Sky News. They don't really know precisely what to do with this attack because Iran has telegraphed in such a way, calculated in such a way, strategically placed it in such a way that I think Israel has a very difficult time considering how to respond to it in a way that America will fully back. I don't think that it can take advantage of this in the way that it was hoping to beforehand.
Might the sort of nature of this attack also have created problems for some of the Arab states who are somewhat awkwardly allied with Israel? So you've got a situation where Jordan, for example, shot a lot of these missiles out of the sky. And you've already got, I presume, Arab populations there who are, you know, somewhat dissatisfied with the fact that their governments haven't stood up for the Palestinians. And now they're actively defending Israel against Iran. Could this create a sticky situation for the likes of Jordan or, say, Saudi Arabia?
Saudi Arabia, I'm not so sure about. Again, I think it remains to be seen how these things develop. But Jordan in particular, I imagine this is going to be somewhat difficult for them to get themselves out of. I mean, with Iran in particular, I think there are going to be conversations between them, their governments, about why Jordan was so willing to open up its airspace to, to close its airspace, but to open it up to take down Iranian missiles that were coming to strike Israel, especially when its population, as you said, is so behind Palestine and Palestinian liberation. As for how sticky it could be, I don't think there's a situation in which Jordan could be, I guess, pulled into conflict of some kind. I don't think that's going to happen. But the strife that the Jordanian government is currently dealing with in regards to its Palestinian population, in regards to its, just population period, I think is going to increase. And I don't think the Jordanian government has, like, a plan that can satisfy both its own population and the Western backers that it is so completely indebted to.
How does this relate sort of specifically to Gaza? And I suppose what I mean by that, I can understand how this response from Iran was, they perceive it as necessary to restore deterrence, to sort of say, Israel, you can't keep encroaching on our national interests, bombing our consulates without any kind of response. So I can see that. When it comes to Israel's war on Gaza, I mean, the most immediate thing that comes to mind is that maybe this is helpful for Israel because there was a, you know, Israel likes to play the victim and they had been struggling, let's say, for the past couple of months because it was so clear that they had overwhelming dominance. And there were discussions sort of in Western capitals. I mean, maybe not that serious, but there were discussions in Western capitals about sort of suspending arms sales to Israel. And potentially they're now in a stronger position to say, no, we need your arms. We are vulnerable. They can play the victim again. How do you think this will relate to Israel's position in its war on Gaza?
What you were saying about them losing support, that I think was the major reason why Israel engaged in these kind of provoking actions as they were doing. They want a war, as I said before, on their terms. They want something that will pull the U.S. back in. They want the love back. They want the international sympathy they had after October 7th back. And that's waning. They need some sort of war that they can perpetrate. And without that, they're going to be in a much more difficult position. I disagree, at least at the moment, with the idea that this could jeopardize the campaign to suspend arms shipments to Israel. Now, if the Iranian attack had been different, with a more explicit aim toward devastation, which they would absolutely be capable of if they wanted to go, I suppose, hypersonic, or they wanted to use more ballistic missiles, but they didn't. If it was more devastating, then maybe Israel would have a point, but what I've been seeing, it's so transparent. It's so evidently warmongering that I think Israel, that like this campaign, I don't think is going to be much interrupted. But, and just in relation to the discussion about how this relates to Gaza, this hasn't been directly parallel in the same way that the Houthi movement's intervention has been, where there is a direct cause and effect. But this still relates to Gaza in that Israel is trying to extract itself from that situation that it's placed itself in, but also that Israel has not been striking Iran, Iranian troops, Iranian allies. It hasn't been striking it. It's been striking it because they've been supporting Palestinian movements and they've been supporting groups that are allied to the Palestinian movement. Even if it's not directly connected, it's all within that framework. Israel needs to get its footing back because of how much it's destroyed its international reputation over Gaza. But again, it's the same mistake that they've made with the Abraham Accords to some degree. You can't bypass this. You can't bypass the situation in Gaza. It is kind of the thing that everything orbits around to some degree. When you try to bypass it and you try to get some other conflict elsewhere, that is not going to end well for you. I don't think it's possible.
I'll attempt to summarize, because I think this is now becoming a bit clearer in my mind. So if you were sort of to look at the Iranian action as, you know, very effective and sort of carried out according to plan, you could say what they've done is restored deterrence by showing that they have the capacity to hit Israel from Iran, and they're willing to sort of take that kind of risk. But because they haven't killed anyone, it's very hard for Israel to sort of play the victim. If they'd killed some people, then I'm sure we would be seeing their faces, and then there would be this big emotional outpouring among, you know, fake or not, among sort of Israel's geopolitical allies. But the fact that no one has died, and everyone's very well aware that 30,000 people at least have been killed in Gaza, that does mean that it is harder for Israel to sort of reposition itself as the victim who needs our sort of support, both militarily and moral. I mean, does that sound sort of reasonable to you as sort of a take on what we saw this weekend?
That's, I think, precisely it. You know, Israel... I'll bring up a good example just to like illustrate the point I'm trying to make, because I think it sounds a bit speculative. Naftali Bennett, the former prime minister, who is in the anti-Netanyahu coalition, mind you, he had posted this screed on Twitter where he talked about Israel needing to become the Silicon Valley Sparta. And he had talked explicitly about Israel becoming wary of taking casualties. Like, this is a political movement in very much in the mainstream in Israel that is wants to reshape Israel into this very militaristic state, more so than it already is, and also that people should like be willing to utilize the fact that people are dying in order to advance its aims. That's what they wanted out of this. And without that clear angle, I mean, the only person that's been injured was a Bedouin girl in a village that Israel doesn't authorize the existence of, that is very hard to sell. And you see it with the angles that the IDF is taking, where they're talking about how Israel is protecting houses of worship because there were missiles that were seen flying away from Al-Aqsa Mosque. Therefore, they were targeting Al-Aqsa Mosque and the IDF protected them, which is this nonsense opinion. When 1,000 mosques have been destroyed in Gaza, they have to talk about how the embassy that they destroyed in Damascus wasn't actually an embassy, even though it was at the embassy complex in Damascus. They're flailing. They don't know what to do with the fact that Iran, which ensured its survival by being strategic and knowing how to calibrate its responses, that it did not immediately go to, I guess, attempt the destruction of Tel Aviv. It really doesn't know what to do with that sort of response. And I think the war cabinet, as we speak, is meeting, and they might decide to do a retaliation with or without Biden's support. But again, I don't think they're going to get the response to this that they're hoping to get. They have a script that they need to follow. And I think they might try to follow it even if it's not going to go how they want to.
That was Seamus Malakoff-Saleh speaking to me earlier today. And as Seamus mentioned there, Israel's war cabinet has this afternoon reconvened to discuss the country's response to Iran's retaliatory attack. Israel's Channel 12 News has reported it as deciding that, quote, the country's objective is to hurt Iran without causing an all-out war. And a government spokesperson said this: Israel retains all its options. We reserve the right to do everything in our power, and we will do everything in our power to defend this country. For its part, Iran's foreign minister has warned that if Israel retaliates, Iran's response will be stronger than what occurred this weekend and instant. Let's go straight on to our next story. Britain's Foreign Secretary David Cameron has rushed out to condemn Iran's recent attacks on Israeli territory. However, he has been far less willing to speak out against the event that precipitated Iran's actions, namely Israel's attacks on the Iranian consulate in Syria, which killed 13. Kay Burley grilled him on that seeming hypocrisy.
Is it bad judgment or good judgment to hit Iranian sovereign territory in Damascus?
Look, that's something the Israelis decided to do. I'll answer the question, which is, I can completely understand the frustration the Israelis feel when they look at the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and they look at the terrible things that they have done all over the world, including the support they give to Hamas. And of course, Hamas were responsible for October the 7th, and that is where all of this begins.
That is where all of this begins. We've heard that before. That is where this all began on October the 7th. Please do not look before then. Do not look to the 56-year illegal occupation. Do not look to sort of Israel's multiple attacks on Iranian sort of assets in the region. Do not look at the United States taking out Iran's principal military leader, Qasem Soleimani, a few years ago, right? Don't look at anything before October the 7th. And then maybe you'll see that Iran are the big evil force in the world and everyone else is just reasonably responding to an unprovoked attack. And let's go back to that exchange. Will David Cameron admit it was irresponsible and provocative for Israel to bomb an Iranian consulate?
You can completely understand the frustration.
Yeah, but what about Iran's frustration at part of its sovereign territory being flattened?
Well, I would argue there is a massive degree of difference between what Israel did in Damascus and, as I said, 301 weapons being launched by the state of Iran at the state of Israel. For the first time, a state-on-state attack, 101 ballistic missiles, 36 cruise missiles, 185 drones. That is a degree of difference.
Yeah.
And I think a reckless and dangerous thing for Iran to have done. And I think the whole world can see all these countries that have somehow wondered, well, you know, what is the true nature of Iran? It's there in black and white.
Now, you can measure sort of actions in terms of the number of weapons used, or you can measure them in terms of how many people were killed, right? Now, in this particular action, Iran have sent more weapons towards Israel than Israel sent towards the Iranian consulate in Syria. Of course, there's no comparison between the weapons that Israel has dropped on Gaza, but if we're just looking at Iran and Israel, yes, Iran sent more weapons Israel's way than Israel sent to the Syrian or the Iranian consulate in Syria. There's another big difference, though, which is that the Israeli attack actually killed people. It killed 13 people, and that's because Israel didn't give any warning, right? The Iranians sent these weapons over to Israel, but they gave, days of warning and then hours of warning after they launched them, right? So Iran knew full well that this wasn't going to kill people. I don't think they wanted this to kill people, whereas Israel had planned to kill people, and that's why they kept it a secret. So you can say, oh, these are completely different because Iran sent X number of weapons. Yeah, well, who actually killed people? In this instance, it was the Israelis. And let's go back to the clip because Kay Burley did have a decent question for David Cameron.
What would Britain do if a hostile nation flattened one of our consulates?
Well, we would take the very strong action.
And Iran would say that that's what they did?
Well, what they did, as I said, was a massive attack.
So they were right to respond, but they overreacted, is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that the attack they carried out was on a very large scale, much bigger than people accepted.
But did they have a right to respond?
Well, countries have a right to respond when they feel they've suffered an aggression. Of course they do. But look at the scale of that response. Had those weapons not been shot down, there could have been thousands of casualties, including civilian casualties. I think that's a really important point to take into account.
Had those weapons not been shot down, there could have been thousands of civilian casualties. Now, Iran say that all those weapons, in any case, were directed towards military targets, not towards Israeli cities. Obviously, Israel bombed Gazan cities to dust, right? But the more important thing here is sort of David Cameron sort of making it seem as if what Iran wanted to do, was kill thousands and thousands of civilians. And it's only because of sort of the quick, prompt action of Israel and the West that that didn't happen. I think it's very clear for any objective analyst, in fact, no one is suggesting otherwise, really, that Iran didn't want to kill people. And that's why they gave so much warning to the world. And they know that Israel has an iron dome. They know that the Western powers would be able to shoot their drones out of the sky, right? So the idea that they were planning to kill thousands of civilians, but it was thwarted, is just fundamentally misleading. Ash, do you think that interview would have convinced many people?
I don't think that it will have convinced many people, because what you're seeing in action with David Cameron is the impossibility for a Western politician to say with a straight face that there is one consistent rule applied to every country in the world and a single system of international law that everybody has to abide by. Because Iran is supposed to accept an attack on its, you know, embassy compound in Damascus, which killed 13 people, without any form of military response. But that would, of course, be completely unacceptable had that occurred to one of the UK's embassy compounds in a foreign country. Israel is able to respond to the Hamas October 7th attacks with a completely disproportionate, indiscriminate, and indeed genocidal assault on a largely civilian enclave of 2 million people. But Iran can't, you know, launch drones at military targets. Now, this isn't me sitting here and going, okay, what we're going to do is cheer for Iran. What I'm pointing out is that there is a completely inconsistent system at play within Western geopolitics and indeed political morality, because what they've done is hitched their apple wagon to, you know, the flailing snake that is Israel, sort of, you know, firing off and spitting in every direction. You know, Israel can commit war crimes in Gaza. It can, you know, launch a missile attack on Beirut. It can be fighting in the south of Lebanon and bomb an embassy compound in Syria. Those are incredibly provocative actions, whatever way you look at them. And no one else is allowed to respond militarily. Why? Well, because, you know, Israel is one of the UK's allies. Now, I would have some degree of respect for a politician or indeed a journalist who would just pop up and say, you know what, the rules are different and we came up with them for reasons of political convenience. And what matters now is the UK's interests, not a system of international law that has any integrity. I would have a degree of respect for that honesty. But no one comes close to that honesty. Instead, what they're doing is this, you know, crazy dance of saying, you know, 300 drones, absolutely terrible. History began on October 7th, bombing an embassy, killing 13 people, completely fine. And even if it was a military target in Damascus, how do you think the UK would respond to a hostile state attacking one of our military targets? We would consider that an act of war and aggression.
I know you're saying, even if it were, it wasn't a military target, it was a diplomatic target. So it's against international law, even if you are at war, and they weren't at war. So, I mean, I think in a way, I know what you're saying. You know, this is not to defend Iran's action. I'm not here to defend the Iranian regime. I'm sure they're not my people, right? In any way, the Islamic Republic of Iran, right? I'm not into, you know, religion fusing with politics, really. And I'm sure, you know, I'm not signed up to all of their foreign policy commitments. But if you ask me what is the most palatable way to try and restore deterrence, restoring deterrence meaning that, you know, Israel kept encroaching on their interests, they have to say, well, we are going to respond. The most morally sort of, the most palatable way to restore deterrence is to do a big set piece action where no one dies, right? No one died. I think it's really difficult for sort of all these politicians to be sort of standing with outrage. This is a completely different category to everything else we've seen over the past 6 months. Israel's war on Gaza, 33,000 people have died. This action by Iran against Israel, which we're all supposed to be so totally outraged about, this is a completely different level of what we're looking at here. Zero people died, right? So it seems a little bit weird to say that we're drawing the red line at what Iran have done and not what Israel have done over the past 6 months. Let's stick with David Cameron, because in an interview on Radio 4's Today programme, the question of Britain's arms sales to Israel came up. It began with Nick Robinson pressing Cameron on why Israel is still allowed to ignore international law in Gaza.
Isn't the possibility that they're simply not listening, that they regard the fact that the British government continues to sell them arms, does not declare them in breach of international law, which you hinted only a month ago that you might well do, by the way, and think the British government, forget what they say, they're effectively giving us a green light to continue as we have been in Gaza.
I don't accept that for a moment. If that was the case, why are they now saying they're going to open the Ashdod port? Why are they opening new crossings? Why are they saying they're going to switch the water pipes back on into Gaza? Why are they doing all of the things that we and others have been asking for? So I think we have been forceful. But on the broader question, we have a very strict set of guidelines for dealing with arms exports. But I think, what Saturday night in many ways proved is that Israel does need the right to defend itself and indeed the means to do so. I mean, had these weapons got through, we could have seen thousands of people killed, including citizens of Israel, and a very significant escalation in this conflict. So
they need the British, they need the French, they need the Jordanians and the Americans, and that perhaps, despite the words, which I accept that you've uttered since you become Foreign Secretary, you haven't used proper leverage, which is saying, if you don't do what we are recommending, you're on your own.
I think the leverage you're suggesting, that somehow Britain, uniquely amongst countries that are supporters of Israel and significant global players, if we uniquely said we're going to put in place an arms embargo, A, I think that would be wrong. B, I think it would have looked ridiculous in the light of the attack that Israel suffered from Iran. And C, I think it would make us give us less leverage rather than more.
Every one of those 3 points was wrong, right? If you say we will withdraw arms if you don't do X, Y, Z, that gives you more leverage, right? The idea that we have more leverage because we've said we're not going to withdraw arms, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Also, the idea that we're just some small nation, so it doesn't matter, right? If we, in terms of brute quantity, we are just a small nation in terms of the arms we sell to Israel. I think we sell 1% of their arms comes from us. We sell lots more to Saudi Arabia for them to commit human rights abuses with. But the political significance of that would be huge. We have a seat on the permanent, we are a permanent member of the Security Council, right? So it's just completely bizarre as sort of the British Foreign Secretary to sort of say, well, it doesn't really matter what we do anyway. We're just a small country, right? So we're going to keep arming them to commit these atrocities. I have sort of seen some people worried, there was some momentum building behind the movement to say, stop arming Israel. Do you think that the fact that these rockets went from Iran to Israel and were shot out of the sky, do you think that will sort of re-energize the people who want to arm Israel?
I think it undoubtedly has. And one of the things to remember is that the Palestinian people are considered collateral by Western powers and what they consider their geopolitical interests to be in the region. The reason why they arm Israel in the way that they do, the reason why America gives Israel billions and billions of dollars in military aid every year, isn't because, in their heart of hearts, they, really believe in Zionist nationalism, although of course that is there. It's because they consider Israel to be an outpost of Western interests in the Middle East. And I think that's always been the real politique behind it. Now, for me, empowering a state which has no regard for international law, which has no regard for humanitarian law, which I don't think is abiding by the terms of the Rome Statute, and saying that these systems of international governance won't apply to you, I think in the long run, that isn't something that's in the interests of people in the UK or indeed America. And we've seen that in recent weeks. Israel repeatedly bombed a car carrying aid workers, including British and American nationals. And while there was a little bit of like, oh, no, sorry, we made a mistake, And then we made two more mistakes at the same target. There wasn't any sense of real remorse or a change in strategy on Israel's part, because they know that the bargain that British and American governments have made with them is that they can do effectively what they want, just so long as they're a bulwark against Iran and, you know, Arab states which aren't aligned with Britain and America. So yeah, I am concerned that one of the impacts of Iran's drone attack over the weekend is that it will have taken mainstream political support away from the cause of stopping arms to Israel. But I'm equally confident that there will be another Israeli atrocity potentially carried out with those weapons before long.
It would be better if there weren't. I mean, in a way, I feel like the response to this has been less. I mean, as sort of Seamus was speaking to me earlier, I do think that potentially the Israelis are finding it harder to form a narrative than they would have thought. Because I think because no one died, so it's very difficult to sort of like play the victim. You know, if people had been killed, we would have had their faces everywhere. And then we'd had, you know, the American politicians standing up there and say this was a cold-blooded murder of XYZ person. Because no one died, I think it is difficult for Israel to position itself as the victim when it's killed so many people in Gaza. So I hope that that not many people are going to buy this line, that Israel needs still for us to send them arms for defensive capacities. Because, yes, Britain and America say, well, we're not going to take part in a counterattack against Iran. But whatever you do, Israel, we will protect you from the consequences of your actions. And if you're protecting someone from the consequences of their actions, regardless of what actions they commit, you are liable for what they do, right? Israel only has the confidence to bomb Iran's consulate because it knows that if Iran is to respond, the Americans will step in and defend them. If the Americans hadn't offered to step in and defend Israel sort of unconditionally, Israel would not have bombed the Iranian consulate. If they knew that they didn't have the Americans to step in when sort of there was any blowback from what they've done in Gaza, they wouldn't have killed 33,000 people in Gaza. So the line that I think the Western governments are trying to take, which is we will help them defend themselves, but we're not going to help them attack Iran. If you are unconditionally helping defend them, you are helping them attack Iran. That's how that works. I'm sorry. Let's go on to our next story. Slightly different, this one. Rule number one of responsible journalism should be this. When a violent attack happens in a city anywhere in the world, don't publicly jump to conclusions about who did it, right? It should be simple. But two people who should know better fell foul of that dictum this weekend. Talk TV's Julia Hartley Brewer and Countdown's Rachel Riley. This was after an attack in Australia that killed six people. And Hartley Brewer tweeted this: another day, another terror attack by another Islamist terrorist. Six dead, others seriously injured, including a baby. Today it's Australia's turn. The other day it was France's. It'll be our turn again next. How long do our governments think we're going to put up with this? And that post got thousands of retweets, 12,000 likes. Rachel Riley, for her part, tweeted this: for 6 months now, people have been out on our streets proudly calling for Intifada revolution. If you want to know what globalized the Intifada looks like, see the Sydney Mall. Five victims stabbed to death and eight transferred to hospital, including a baby, due to one man and a knife. In the second Intifada, over 1,000 Israelis were murdered in restaurants, on buses, and in the streets by suicide bombings, stabbings, stonings, lynching, shooting, rockets. The youngest victim was just 9 hours old. Sydney Mall, multiple times over, is what they've been proudly calling for. The problem with both of those tweets: the killer was not an Islamist. He had nothing to do with Palestine or any global Intifada. In fact, the stabbings were committed by a white Australian man, right? Rachel Riley has apologized for her tweet and deleted it. Julie Hartley Brewer has kept hers up. She sort of admitted she was mistaken, but for some reason thinks she should still leave it up. Very bizarre. The Independent, at least, didn't pull their punches when covering the story. So they say, Rachel Riley says she's sorry if racist post about Sydney attack was misunderstood. So they've called the post racist. So Rachel Riley is known to be somewhat litigious. So, I mean, I think our lawyers would probably tell us, be careful about saying it's a racist post in a YouTube thing, because you'll get a letter from our lawyers. But the Independent, credit to them, have been confident enough to say this is a racist post, and to say this is about a global Intifada when it had nothing to do with Palestine or Muslims or anything like that. We'll come on to more of the reality of the situation that occurred in Sydney in one moment. First, though, Ash, these people are supposed to be professionals. What are they thinking?
Well, okay, there's two things I want to say. The first thing is that all of us have been bitten by the siren call of Twitter, inviting us to leap to conclusions before we've had all the information. And generally, it's just a bit embarrassing. Where I think that these are all kind of egregious cases is that not only did they leap to conclusions, it was seemingly a pretext to blame Muslims and the Palestinian cause more generally. So it wasn't just, okay, well, I made an assumption about what's going on based on partial information. That's fine. It's sort of then going, and this is why these people are barbarous murderers, da 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 da. What that gets you thinking is that that's something that you were just thinking all the time, and you were waiting for a convenient little news hook to hang those very bigoted and, in my opinion, racist perspectives on. And there's something, I think, darkly opportunistic about it. And I think that's what takes it beyond just a sort of, you know, human leaping to conclusions thing that, you know, I think we're all in. You know, very quickly, it all got a bit clash of civilizations. So it's quite revealing about what they're thinking about Muslims more generally, isn't it? Really quite revealing.
Rachel Riley has said that her tweet wasn't meant to imply that Muslims were involved or that this had anything to do with Palestine. And she was merely saying that the second intifada in Israel was violent, and this was an act of violence. So whenever we see an act of violence, we can say it's like the intifada, which doesn't seem that credible to me, but I will. You can go and find her apology statement online and see if you find it particularly convincing. Let's talk about the reality of the attacks, though. It appears they were motivated by an extreme hatred of women. So five of the six people killed were female. The police have already said it was obvious that that's why they were targeted. Really, really tragic, horrific event. The father of the killer appears to have confirmed that theory as well.
Because he wanted a girlfriend, and he's got no social skills, and he was frustrated out of his brain. To you, he's a monster. To me, he was a very sick boy. Believe me, he was a very sick boy. I'm extremely sorry. I'm heartbroken for you. Look, this is so horrendous that I can't even explain it. You're trying to give me, to give you an intelligent conversation. I can't do it because I'm just devastated. I love my son. I made myself a servant to my son when I found out he had a mental illness. I became his servant. I did everything because I love that boy. He let himself down. Because, look, he was taken on medication because he was doing so well, but then he just took off to Brisbane, and I went down there and I spent a day every now and again with him and did everything I can, but then he took off to Sydney.
Incredibly horrific attack. I mean, that was also, I thought it was really tragic watching the killer's father there. Ash, I mean, what can we say about this? I mean, you know, this was clearly an act of violent misogyny. Also, the dad saying this guy had severe mental health difficulties. Can we add anything here?
I think that sometimes we tend to look at things in a very binary way. So we wrongly misrepresent mental health issues as being a, you know, fail-safe indicator that someone has a propensity towards violence. Now, we know that's not true. People with mental health issues are much more likely to be victims of violence than they are to be perpetrators of violence. And the other half of the binary is that when there is some kind of identity-based hatred, whether that's misogyny or a form of racism or homophobia or transphobia or ableism, we look at that as a form of evil and malevolence for which someone is totally and 100% morally responsible. And I think actually that in some cases, particularly in cases like this, the truth can be somewhere in the middle. I think that someone can have mental health issues in a way which potentially makes them less criminally responsible. Their ability to form mens rea, criminal intent, is diminished because of their mental health issues. And also their targets of violence have been shaped by living within a culture or a society which sets up marginalized people as fair game, as people who are deserving of your disdain, your loathing, and your hatred. And that's not saying that this individual is, you know, completely, you know, not to be held responsible for anything he did. And it's also not saying that people with mental health issues are violent. It's not what I'm saying at all. The thing I'm saying is that where you do have an overlap between violence and mental health issues, that can express itself through these structural problems like misogyny.
Yeah, I mean, incredibly tragic situation, which I think was, you know, these two journalists tried to exploit it and they've been found out. I saw someone in the comments say actually that the only man who was killed was a Muslim security guard, which kind of makes the blaming of Muslims. I mean, Rachel Riley would clearly deny that she was blaming Muslims. I don't think Julie Hartley Brewer can possibly claim she wasn't trying to blame. Well, she'd say, I suppose she wouldn't say Muslims, she'd say Islamist extremists. But yeah, I mean, pretty grotesque from both of them, I think. I can see the IDF are holding a news conference, but I think they're just saying again that they retain the right to respond as and when they want. I mean, to sort of close by talking about what we've seen over the weekend, I suppose the big important issue that we're here to discuss. I mean, it is somewhat reassuring that it does seem like nearly all of the powers other than Israel are saying, do not respond to this. You know, it seems like if Iran wanted to put forward a message which is saying, one, we are serious, we're a serious country, you can't just push us around, but two, we don't want this to develop into a regional war. It does seem like, you know, the Americans and the British have got that message and sort of Iran has broadcast its message as they wanted to. The big wild card is whether or not Israel very proactively wants a wider war with Iran. There are obviously two perspectives on this. I've sort of seen lots of reporters saying no one in the region wants a regional war. And we've had Trita Parsi on this show a number of times, who sort of he suggests that actually, potentially, Israel do want a regional war. They've wanted to take out the Iranian regime for about 20 years. And they see this one as a, you know, their best opportunity they've had in a very long time to draw the West into a war with Iran. And two, if there were to be a sort of wider regional conflagration, might be helpful for Netanyahu's career. He needs this war to continue so he doesn't have to resign. And I suppose if there are a wider regional war, then, you know, that might provide some cover for them to carry out their more maximalist aims in Gaza, which is to basically clear everyone out. Ash, sort of any final thoughts on what we might see over the next 24 hours on this story?
Predictions are a mug's game. But I'm inclined to agree with you. I think that when you look at how Israel has conducted itself internationally, particularly since October 7th, it has been reckless in the extreme. It's not the actions of a state that is interested in regional stability. So given a choice between stability and escalation, feel like Israel will choose escalation. The one caveat to that is they can't go further than the Americans are willing to protect them.
The thing is, they might try and force their hand, right? Because I think, you know, even with the consulate, apparently they told the Americans, I think 5 minutes in advance. So it's not that they're sort of saying, they're basically daring the Americans to withdraw support. Because if Israel do the action and then they sort of dare America, you're going to withdraw your defense for us, then America keeps sort of coming forward and say, okay, no, we will defend you. Which means that Netanyahu can keep sort of pushing the limit. For now, thanks to all of you for tuning in. Make sure to come back tomorrow for another stream from 6 p.m. You've been watching Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.